course, I referred to this old geographic. I just happened to pick up for one thing, but it's loaded with things like this here. For example, when the Aztecs came to the Valley of Mexico, and I quote, "Their city's need for firewood was already denuding the Valley of Mexico of trees. An epic famine." We're going to have an epic famine here today, aren't we, that comes. Great famines, deforestation. What we find is steadily advancing drought in these chapters of Helaman. It's very clearly indicated. All these clues are there, you see, and they all fit together so beautifully. But this one, an epic famine in the year one of the rabbit decimated the Mexican people. Their empire might well have fallen before they could employ the arts, the wheel of the bronze. They didn't employ the other things. We don't know about these other things. But how about these merchants going around? When they got prosperous, they learned a thing or two from the Nephites, and they started making money and got rich. Does that mean they had to be wicked? Well, here's a very interesting comment that's made here. This was Tlatelolco. Tlatelolco, the twin city of the Aztec capital and home of the great merchant traders. These men, dressed in deceptively shabby clothes, traveled widely throughout the empire, serving as agents and spies in foreign domains, and stealthily brought great riches home in their cargo canoes, arranging to arrive at night. There's something sinister and underhanded about the whole business, isn't it? Well, that's the nature of business. You have to put one over on the opposition. It is competitive, you see. And when you're competing, this is a very effective way. But what a way of doing it, you see. It's very interesting. Book of Mormon, the implication is that they necessarily go bad in there when they start dealing in riches and being very successful and so forth, dressed in deceptively shabby clothes, traveling as agents and spies. Of course, industrial spies, among other things, technical spies. Stealthily brought great riches. Well, why stealthily? See, in their cargo ships and their barges at night, and arranged to arrive at night, keeping it all secret even to their own people. Well, this is the sort of thing we have in this marvelous book of Helaman, which I say, the dark book, the book of crime here. Now, let's take the 11th chapter here. And after Nephi got out of prison and was delivered, he went on preaching, but didn't do any good. Things got worse and worse. So it starts out, the 72nd year of the judges, the contentions did increase. Things only get worse. Wars throughout the land, among all the people of Nephi. And it was this secret band of robbers who carried on the work of destruction. Notice, these merchant bands we mentioned before, these robber bands we mentioned before, of which there were many, they've dominated every century in the world. They were merchants, too. They were acquiring gain. That was their purpose, power and gain. And they became immensely rich, like the Hospitallers and the Knights of Rhodes and Knights of Malta and so forth, like the Crusading Knights who formed societies, sacred societies, secret brotherhoods, very secret, but ended up owning half the wealth of Europe. And this happened not there, but also in every region of the earth. Oh Lord, do not, Nephi sees the way it's going. This is very bad. He says, do not suffer, this people shall be destroyed by the sword. They've lost all control. When is a famine a blessing? Rather let there be a famine in the land to stir them up to repentance. And so it was done. There was a great famine. We mentioned a great famine here. As I say, it tells us what the famine was due to. Not enough rain. It was dry, it tells us in the sixth verse. It wasn't raining, it was drought. They're going into a dry period here. And can these famines be absolutely devastating? Well, look at Africa. 2-3 years ago, we saw it there. Entire areas of Ethiopia just wiped out. It happened, had nothing to eat. They'd wander for hundreds of miles walking to find a little food, and they'd drop light flies, and whole districts would be wiped out. And it's the same thing here. The work of destruction did cease by the sword, but became sore by famine. For the earth was smitten, and that it was dry, and did not yield forth grain in the season of grain. And the whole earth was smitten, even among the Lamanites as well as among the Nephites, so that they were smitten, they did perish by the thousands, as in vast areas of Africa. And it's happened in Europe, of course, the great famine. Of course, the year 1000, there have been famines that practically wiped out the population of Europe because they had no way of bringing in, well, the great Chinese famine, of course, of early 1900s. They're part of human history, of course, these periodic famines. But this was a beauty. Now, they began to remember their Lord. Now, this is an interesting thing. What is the obsession with the Southwest Indians anyway, with the Pueblos and all those others? It's dry, it's rain. They're always dancing for rain. Always, well, look at the place where they live. What would they think about rain? If it doesn't rain, If it doesn't rain, the Hopis are absolutely finished. Remember, in all the reservation there, they have no stream. There's not a running stream. You have to go all the way to Albuquerque to have baptism. Not to Albuquerque. What's his name? What was the nearest area? Well, you could go. You could go to. That's where they go. You could go for baptism, but in all the Topi villages, we can't baptize. Old Arabi is the only place where there's enough water. Well, there's a sacred spring at the Corn Rocks there, at the Twin Rocks, and at the Second Mesa, and then there is the Jacob's Well at Old Arabi, but the water there is so foul it can't be drunk. Missionaries always get into trouble when they go down there. They try to drink that water. There's not enough water to drink. The water has to be brought up from very few springs by the women in jars on their heads up to the top of the mesa and the trails and so forth. They have no water. Not enough water to baptize. They had to go a great distance to baptize and Taos, someplace like that. I'll think of it in a second. I always think of it in a second. It was so they're always thinking of that. It's a great concern with them. How do they expect to live? Well, you know how they live. What you do, you take a stick and you take 5 kernels of corn and you stick them down 20 inches into the ground with a stick. And you just leave them there the groundwater. We hope there'll be enough groundwater. It has to be in the bottom of a dry wash. Of course, it is Dinebiti Wash, the great wash there, is where most of the corn comes out. Just stick it down and hope it'll grow up. One stalk will grow up about 18 inches and no higher. It'll have 1 ear of corn on it. I've never seen one with more than 2 ears. And 1 ear of corn, exotic corn, various colors, all blue and black and white and everything, and they take them and they pile them carefully like wood, and everybody knows where every ear of corn came from, and they have it all to share. But that's the way they get how they can survive in that. We couldn't do it at all, and that they flourish. It's amazing. And they're not exactly rolling in luxury or anything like that, but they say it's good for them because it has taught them to live more sober and more righteously than they did before. But they began to remember their Lord, because this is it. You're always dependent on that. You're always dependent on Awatobi. If it wasn't for the sky, if it wasn't for the Lord sending rain, you wouldn't last at all. Of course, the same thing in Israel. Exactly the same thing in Israel. The last book of Zechariah, the ending of Zechariah, the last book of the Old Testament, says, upon all those who do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the Lord of hosts at the house of God, there shall be no rain. And that is the ultimate curse. And so that's why you had to go to the temple. And that's called a liturgy. And the liturgy is when, that's the meaning of the word liturgy, is a prayer for rain. The Romans had it way back in prehistoric times. You always had to be done barefooted. You always go in barefoot. And all the people would come to pray. They'd all come. And liturgy, we take it over in churches today because it's one in which the congregation and the clergy and various groups share. It's divided up. They say a line, the priest says a line, or the bishop says a line, and then it's antiphonal, back and forth, and it's their liturgies. I've been to some, say for example in Germany, every line the priest will read a line of prayer, and then the people say "Hear uns," hear us, and then the priest will read on, then "Hear uns." And when there's no rain up there in the cathedral at Reims, very ancient Romanesque cathedral, not in Reims but in Worms, they would go through this sort of thing. So that's a liturgy, and its original idea is this prayer for rain, but it's an obsession with the human race because our livelihood depends on it. And look what happens. What about these great foundations of the Southwest, like Gran Chaco and so forth? Suddenly they disappeared. They were huge things, and the only answer is they dried up. There was nothing to live on. What about the Anasazi? They were everywhere around here, and all of a sudden they're no longer there. This disappearing in the New World is a strange thing. It's peculiar to the Book of Mormon. Promises. You don't find that in the old world. People hang on. They suffer, but they hang on. They don't hang on here. They just vanish. And so we have these litanies. Notice, the chief judges would say unto Nephi, the chief judges said unto Nephi, "Behold, we know that thou art a man of God. Therefore, cry unto the Lord." So they ask the leader to cry unto the Lord, and they're required to join into it because they come in sackcloth. You see, they enter into the thing. It's very much like a rain dance, which is performed every year, and very, very faithfully it has to be. And of course, right now, down at Brian Head, not at Brian Head, yes? It is, Brian. It is down there, isn't it? They're having an Indian dance, it's rain dance, because they want it to snow for the skiing down there. And they hire the Indians to come in and dance for the rain and the snow, and it always has results, apparently. And they're doing it right today. They're having a big dance to make it rain down, snow down at Briardead for business. The world we live in. Nephi saw that the people had repented and humbled themselves in sackcloth. So the people were together in this ordinance, and they cried unto the, and he cried unto the Lord, see. And this people repenteth, they have swept away the band of Gideon, and they have become extinct, they have concealed their secret plans in the earth. In other words, they have gone underground. And because of this humility, turn away thine anger. And so he did. Lord, wilt thou hearken unto me and send forth rain upon the face of the earth, that she may bring forth her fruit and her grain in the season of rain. You know, just the cloud dances and so forth, and all the rain. Yeah? Oh, boy, what a golden.
And you said that meant they went underground.
No, they literally went underground if they buried their secrets in the earth. They'll dig them up later on, don't worry. No, these things are dug and hid. I mean, you find them. They do. They put them in caves and their places, their sacred places, and if you go near those places, you're in real danger because those places are carefully guarded and they have all sorts of things in them. I had quite an adventure in one where you'd never expect there was anything at all, that the whole thing gone underground. Well, anyway, yea, O Lord, thou seest they have repented, and because of the famine, they repented because of the famine and the pestilence. So that was necessary, one thing that could force them. And the Lord did turn away his anger and cause that rain should fall upon the earth. You see, nearly all the dance, they come to themselves, rather than the scratchy scratch that goes this way, and the drums that rattle all the time. That's the sound of rain, and this is the sound of thunder, and they're always imitating rain sounds, thunder sounds, wind sounds, and so forth, because of all things, no matter what the dance is, and they have a dance every weekend, is rain is the main theme. And so it happened, and the people did rejoice and glorify God, and the land was filled with rejoicing. And Lehi's brother was just as diligent as Lehi was in this. And the people of Nephi began to prosper again. Uh-oh, here it comes. And began up to build their waste places until they did cover up the... this building is a constant activity with them. At the turn of the 20th century, and just before that, well, after the Spanish came, it was because of the Spanish more than anything else, the threat that came from the Spanish and the Apaches, the Spanish and the Aztecs, Apaches that came in. All the villages where they're located today, the 12 villages of the Hopi, they're new. Walpi is ancient, First Mesa is ancient, but most of them are new and go back, well, 1906, 1900, around there. These ancient villages that look so ancient, but the villages they came from are standing, but they're ruins now. But they moved all at once. They didn't hesitate to move from their ancestral home, didn't have to move far, but because of the threat that was there, they moved all up to the tops of the mesas. But that wasn't hundreds of years ago, that was quite recently that they did that. But they're ready to move at a moment's notice. That's a surprising thing. We call them Pueblos, the city Indians, because they're stable. The cities have been there. I say Sister Teresa Harvey's house has stood there for 1,100 years, but 1,100 century years. But they're ready to move whenever they're supposed to. And this is the way they do. They did multiply. They did cover the whole face of the land, both northward and south, and from the sea east to west. We're still down in the narrow there, in the peninsula. There's a relatively small area, one would suppose. And the church spread among both the Nephites and the Lamanites. There were a few contentions on points of doctrine. And much strife, Nephi and Lehi having many revelations daily, they preached and put an end to the strife that same year. And then there was a certain number of dissenters, and who had gone over unto the Lamanites. Here, your race question again. The Lamanites, they're always mixing themselves up together. There's no distinction. Gone over to the Lamanites and taken upon themselves the name of Lamanites. Well, that made them Lamanites. And now we're back to this, a new technique here, and this is the robber's ruse technique. Now, Utah has a number of nice robber's ruse, doesn't it? And there's one out by Helper. There is one in Capitol Reef, which has Butch Cassidy's name, Butch spelt out in bullets on the wall up at the big bridge, big arch there, when you go back on the trail. There's one in southern Utah. There's, lots of them. But there are lots of robber's ruse. My next-door neighbor lived right around the corner from me, Brother Swap. He was a gigantic man, about 7 feet tall, big man. I was his home teacher for years. And he used to be the sheriff in Price and in Bluff. of all places, and he knew Butch Cassidy very well. They got along famously together, and he knew my grandfather very well. My grandfather used to drive down there in a horse and buggy on church and other business, and he'd drive along with Brother Swap, but Brother Swap still remembered it, all these things that went on, and how could these people get away with it? He's just a very genial person. All I had to do was drop back into see, before they filled, before they filled the dam at Glen Canyon there, well, and others down south, you go down to Lake Mead and the other lake, and the there were all sorts of places to hide down there. There's all these little nooks and crannies. Well, you know how it is like that in the Red Rock Country. Some of it, I can remember when very little of it had been explored at all. It was absolutely unknown quite recently. And so they'd fall back in those. And the Indians still do. There's still groups, the One Horn, there, the One Horn, the Two Horn tribes, or the societies. They hide out there. These bands of robber plays an important role. This is a technique peculiar to the terrain. They can use it by falling back in these places. Notice, they would commit murders and retreat back into the mountains and into the wilderness and secret places, hiding themselves and receiving daily addition to their numbers. Well, what do you think of that? What opera do you think of there, Act Two? Do you think of that? It's Act Two of Carmen, remember? The robbers hide out in the mountains. And Carmen playing with the cards and so forth, finding out the doom motif. Yeah, the robbers are hiding out in the mountains. Everything is very secret, everything is very hush-hush and so forth. Robbers hiding out in the mountains of Italy, in the mountains of Sicily, in the mountains of Spain, in the mountains of Portugal. Anywhere you go, you'll find them doing this, hiding out in the mountains and hills, and in the hills of Scotland. You know, the famous Rob Roy, the family, the Sawney Bean family, they were famous shipwreckers and so forth, made themselves rich in the most vicious ways, but always hid out in the highlands. There was no place you could trace them. And this has been a technique also that the earth's terrain provides, that sort of protection. This isn't just the big city operations you have. These are these specialties. We talked about the Cess and the Riffs and the Battalion Brethren and so forth, and the Algerian pirates and the Vikings and the Free Companies and the Bedou and the Assassins. They all worked in different ways, but this particular technique has been highly developed by some of the Southwest Indies. The robber's roost technique in the Darnay, the freebooters. And they defied whole armies here. It was the Druze, Al Daruzi in 1070. He was a leader of a robber band in Egypt, and he was driven out. And so he retreated to South Lebanon and discovered there this marvelous figure, just like Rock Canyon there. They're in South Lebanon, you see. These very steep mountains, they're terraced now, with lots of deep crevices and ravines and places to hide in. And they hid out there in South Lebanon. They've been there ever since, known as the Druze, and they're very dangerous. I've always wanted to visit the Druze, and I was able with President Barnes of American University in Beirut years ago. We spent some time up there because he was very popular with them. He got along with them famously, and I found some very interesting things about them. They always intermarry. They're very suspicious. They're beautiful people, and they're nearly all redheads, showing that they're intermarried and so on. They're the fiercest fighters in the East, and they're completely independent, living in these mountains, you see, and everybody's afraid of them, and they can sell their services to Israel or to Islam as they please and so forth. There's some very interesting things about them. They go way back to early times. And at the same time, a few years later, from the east, moving into the same mountains, discovering the mountains, was the old man of the mountain, Hassan ibn Sabah, who was a Persian. And he settled at Alamut, which was on a mountain east of there. And from there, he terrorized the entire Europe everywhere, sending out his assassins. I said his kids were hopped up with this stuff. But the idea is you have a base, you have a hiding place in the mountains. A hiding place in the mountains is the thing. And so it says here, incidentally, they're still being used. They're being used quite effectively in some parts. There's some parts you can't go in South Houston, Northern Arizona, and so forth. I've got into some. Several years ago, it was March 15th, the night of the Hehawuti, a very important thing when they have no lights, everything is in the dark. And if they catch you out there, they'll say, Hawati, let me see, that's it. Hawati, yes, they say, who are you? And you reply, Pin'iu, I am myself. But when they come up in the dark, and there's two societies. There's the One Horn Society, who are very sinister and very dangerous, and look out for them. They can do anything they want. The Two-Horn Society is benevolent and try to protect you from the One-Horn Society, see? They try to get there first, because the One-Horns mean to do damage. They mean mischief. And they come up to you in the dark and ask you who you are. And the... trying to think what the phrase is. See what having a cold does? The same thing that not having a cold does. Maybe I'm crowding it too fast, yes?
Are these Lamanite people?
Well, they're Lamanites, Nephites, all this mixture. They're mixed up with everything. Now I'm stuck. Better put it back on again. It's too warm in here. The, of course they're... They're as near as you can get to Lamanite. Remember, all we've been getting is a mixture. These people we're talking about here had gone over to the Lamanites, take upon the Lamanites, and these were the people who were plundering. There were Nephites who joined the Lamanites. They're all mixed up together. And it's interesting, of course, the Southwest Indians, these Pueblo Indians, are the most citified and always identified by the early brethren, like Wilfred Woodruff and Lorenzo Snow and so forth. They always recognize them as Nephites because their customs and so forth. And Hamblin, Jacob Hamblin, always accepted them. But they were able to hold their own, and therefore they sent an army of strong men into the wilderness upon the mountains that would take care of them. But it didn't work. They were driven back. Well, remember the story of Spartacus and the gladiators. They hid out for a long time in the crater of Vesuvius, and that was their hideout. Of course, it wasn't a secret hideout. People knew where it was then. But there they held their own against Roman armies. And they did go forth again and destroyed many of them, but they didn't get rid of them. Then it came to pass, thus ended this year, and the robbers did increase and wax strong. And this is like Medellin now. Medellin, you see, we're going to see the same thing there. They defy whole armies of the Nephites here. These bands of robbers could do it, like the Umsburg. They were the armies, as far as that goes. They were just the other side. They considered themselves that way. And they did visit many parts of the land with great destruction. This is a standard practice in later years. We talk about the wild Indians, things like that. They were the wild ones. And did kill many and carry many captives away. It's very interesting in the 13th century, later on, we're talking about these same after the old man of the mountain got established with his assassin organization, and the Druze got established almost at the same time, and the crusading orders, the militant orders of the Crusades got established, just as sinister, just as greedy, just as dangerous. They fought each other, so forth. After they got established, then came the big boys. In the middle of the 13th century came Hulagu and the Mongols, and they just wiped out everything. When he came to Baghdad, which was a flourishing city of the Abbasids then, it was at its peak, they killed everybody in the city. This is the way they were systematic, these people. So the sorts of going on here aren't very pleasant, are they? Now this, especially, and they carried the maid captain, especially women and children, of course, for ransom and to keep. They had to build up their numbers and their strength, their own empire. That's the way Genghis Khan, the great Khans, did. They just sucked them up like a vacuum cleaner so they could count them into their people. This great evil did finally stir up the people's remembrance. Well, hadn't the drought done that enough? No, it had to be this. Now we get on top of the drought, we got the gangs here, the raids. And didn't do any good, though. Back to verse 36. The needles stuck in the same old groove again. They began again to forget the Lord their God, and began to wax strong in iniquity. They did not mend their ways, and waxed stronger and stronger in their pride. What do you conclude from this? Do we have to repeat this so often? That's exactly what Nephi says in the next verse. That's in the next verse here. The next verse, next chapter. This chapter 12 is wisdom literature. This is a unique chapter, very striking chapter, a very typical chapter of ancient literature. It's called the Lamentation or Wisdom Literature. The most reliable sources we have, both from Egypt and Babylonia, are the Lamentation literature. Lambert collected the Lamentation literature of Babylonian. The literature of the Egyptians is more famous. It goes right back to the beginning, to the earliest times, and it's always the man lamenting that people have no wisdom at all. Could great men son remember what Isabella says at the beginning of... It's that people are just damn fools, is the point here. And they will they ever get any sense, see? As Isabella says, in the in Measure for Measure, the great man thunder as Jove does. Jove would ne'er be silent. For every petty pelting officer would use Jove's heaven for thunder, nothing but thunder. Use his heaven for thunder, nothing but thunder. And then he says, Merciful heaven, he says, do you rather with thy sharp and sulphurous bolt rend the unwedgeable and knotted oak than the soft myrtle? See, Jove uses his bolt for objects worthy of it, a gnarled and hard, unwedgeable oak. But the high officials, they use all their power on weaker people. They work on the soft myrtle and so forth. But man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, most ignorant of what he's most assured, his angry image, his glassy image like an angry ape, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep. Who, had they our spleen, would all themselves laugh human. They'd laugh silly if angels could laugh. You should have seen what we do. Man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, he's generalizing, most ignorant of what he's most assured, he thinks himself everything, his glassy image like an angry ape, a senseless prancing and display before a mirror, his glassy image like an ape, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep. The angels would laugh if they could, but they can only weep. And this is the story, you see, we have here. How false and how and also the unsteadiness of the hearts of the children of men. Yea, we see now he lays down a law of human nature or human condition here. At the very time when he doth prosper his people, why can't he prosper us and they enjoy that? Then at the bottom of the verse, then is the time that they do harden their hearts and do forget the Lord their God and do trample under their feet the Holy One of Israel, and this because of their great ease and exceeding great prosperity. Why must it do that to them? And why must be clamoring for more ease and prosperity now? And are we the exception? Except the Lord doth chasten his people. They just had a major drought. They just had a crime wave that practically wiped everybody out. Then civil wars, having an awful time, you see. And unless that sort of thing happens, what do they do? He has to visit them with things like this. They want riches. They want famine and terror and all manner of pestilence. They won't remember him. And now comes the reflection on human nature. This is a soliloquy, you see. A simple statement of fact here. Oh, how foolish, how vain, how evil, how devilish, how quick to do iniquity and how slow to do good are the children of men. There's a nice reflection on human nature. Yea, how quick to hearken unto the words of the evil one and to set their hearts upon the vain things of the world. Here we are again. Here is another. Did I mark this at all? No, I didn't. Well, where this lamentation literature reaches its peak in this wisdom literature, as you know, is in you wouldn't know the Egyptian, but in Hebrew, of course, this is your book of Ecclesiastes and so forth. The wisdom literature of the Hebrew is very close to the Egyptian literature, very much. They quote from each other, as a matter of fact. The wisdom of Solomon and the wisdom of Amenemhat, they overlap each other. The Amenemhat's thousands of years older. But they say it's the same thing. The human race is just this way, and this is what it's always going to be this way. Since the beginning of the world, it's never got any better. How quick to be lifted up in pride, no needing for that. Man, vain man, like. Yea, how quick to boast and do all manner of that which is iniquity. And how slow are they to remember the Lord their God and to give ear unto his counsel. Yea, how slow to walk in wisdom's path. See, this is wisdom literature. This should be capitalized, I suppose. I'll see if I have an earlier edition of the Book of Mormon. Because that's the Chokhmah literature of the Hebrews. Chokhmah, they always capitalize wisdom, you see, in the Hebrew writings. They're always talking about as if it was a person. And it's so in the Pearl of and Doctrine and Covenants, too. And Pearl of Great Price, wisdom is as if it were a person. Wisdom and her children. How slow to walk in wisdom paths. Behold, they do not desire that the Lord who hath created them should rule and reign over them. That's something. This wisdom literature. He's given them the law of consecration, for example. They don't want it. They won't have anything to do with it. Minchie mentioned it up there. Immediately come up with arguments against it. But if they liked it, they wouldn't do that. And notwithstanding his great goodness and mercy toward them, they do set at naught his counsels. They will not that he should be their guide. Oh, now here it climaxes in this, you see. Well, Hamlet says the same thing here. Oh, how great is the nothingness of the children of men, yea, even they are less than the dust of the earth. Man, this quintessence of dust. Let me see. Yes. But what to me is this quintessence of dust? Man, what does it mean not? I'll think of it in a second. Well, I will, in just a second now. Yeah. he first tells what a piece of work is man, remember, in action, how like a god, in motion, how like an angel, the paragon of animals, the beauty of the nature, the paragon of animals, the beauty of the earth, and so forth. Oh, yes, and what to me is this quintessence of dust? Man pleaseth me not. But he calls him just a quintessence of dust. After saying all these wonderful things about what man is, yet he's nothing at all. And the same thing here. He could have been all these other things, but he says, no, he is nothing. The children of men are nothing. They are less than the dust because the dust obeys. Now, this is a standard statement of wisdom literature. See, the stars in their courses. All nature obeys God's command. All nature works together. And this, we see, is the way it works. Of course, everything's fitted into a single system. And so we have the basic idea of ecology. Everything is there. It should be. The predators are there, and all the other things are there. The plants, the animals, everything fits in. Everything works together, except man works against it. Man's the only one who can break up the ecological chain and wreck everything, which of course we're doing on a massive scale today. And for this reason, you see, the dust of the earth moves hither and thither, remembers? The voice of the hills, the mountains do tremble and shake. See, all nature obeys what God wants, and so all nature is running the same way on the freeway, so to speak. And man alone wants to run in the opposite direction, and so he thinks nature's fighting him. He thinks nature's opposed him. He thinks fate is against him. He thinks God is cruel because of these things we do. You know, how cruel is life? How unjust is life, and so forth. And we're the ones that are making all the trouble. Because by the power of his voice, they are broken up and become smooth, see? And by the power of his voice does the earth shake, the foundations of the rock. Notice this is all prearranged. It is all timed. So it is by a power. It is by a power of arrangement. It's on certain principles that have always been set, that have already been set forth. And it does happen. And then he does a very interesting thing in the wisdom literature. You must always have a bit of cosmology comes in there because man has to be fitted into the big picture. And here it comes. He's going to give us some astronomy here. And it appeareth, no, and thus, according to his word, the earth goeth back, and it appeareth unto man that the sun standeth still. Yea, and behold, this is so. For surely it is the earth that moveth, and not the sun. He puts in this little note. It's with much behind him here. Ignored subjects, see the elements. In the rigid editing of the Book of Mormon, we're not going in to go into cosmological discourses here. You can be sure that the Nephites were very much concerned with those things. And the same thing with ancient. You won't find astronomical discourses where you expect them in any of the wisdom literature. But then they will come out with something that man has to work with other things. It's the earth moveth and not the sun to show that he is up on things. And the waters of the great deep, then he goes on this thing. And if a man hide it, he's going to treat this a little later on in this 18th verse, a little later on. Behold, if a man hide up a treasure in the earth, the Lord shall say, let it be accursed because of his iniquity. Hide it shall be accursed. This often happens. And then, hey, who shall, the final verse, who shall be consigned to a state of endless misery, fulfilling the words which say, well, what words are we talking about? Well, he's quoting the Memphite code here, the oldest document in existence, the Shabako stone, which says, they have done good shall have everlasting life, they have done evil shall have everlasting damnation. He tells us he's quoting from the old source here. He says, even the endless misery, fulfilling the words which say, what words? They're not his words, you see. They're fulfilling certain words he's quoting here. Well, you can find the same words, I say, in the Memphite text, which you won't go into too long. We have to hurry up to get this through with Helaman now. And now, there is a complete reversal between Nephites and Lamanites here. And we get Samuel Lamanite. Now, here's another great episode, Samuel the Lamanite and his preaching here. The Nephites did remain wicked, and the Lamanites did observe strictly to keep the commandments of God according to the law of Moses. Remember, they're still keeping the law of Moses. Well, that's something. And, wow, these things leap. There was one Samuel, the Lamanite. Well, who cares? There was one Samuel, the Lamanite, who came into the land of Zarahemla to preach to them. That's turning the tables, isn't it? Behold, the voice of the Lord came unto him, that he should prophesy unto him whatsoever things should come into his heart. Well, he's persona non grata. They don't want him. They would not suffer that he should enter into their city. Therefore, he got up on the wall thereof. Of course, you have that absurd picture of Arnold Freiberg, where he's on a 150-foot wall with a howling wind going, and he's yelling. Of course, nobody could hear a sound from there. And the archers are trying to shoot at him at that vast distance. And so they didn't need walls that high, you know. Ridiculous. Well, it's just dramatic. This sort of thing is good for candy box covers and things like that. Whatsoever things the Lord put into his heart. Inspiration is unforced. Just let it flow freely. That's exactly the way Solomon begins his work of wisdom, which revolutionized, of course, the Athenian society. And the sword of justice doth hang over this people. The same expression is used in Mormon 8 and 4 when it talks about people of our day who, why do you clothe yourself with that which has no life and allow the poor, the sick, the afflicted to go unnoticed and so forth? You turn the backs on the poor and the sick and notice them not. Behold, the sword of justice hangs over you and it shall soon fall to your utter destruction. And so then a heavy destruction awaiteth this people. Nothing but repentance can save them. And behold, an angel of the Lord declaimed it up to me, an angel again, the glad tidings, but you wouldn't receive me. Therefore, I will take away my word from them, withdraw myself, I will suffer them no longer. But then he says the fourth generation. The tenth verse, heavens, if we've got to wait four generations, that doesn't bother us now. We'll cross that road when we get to it, as Carlos O'Hara says. I'll think about that tomorrow. Yes, there shall be those of the fourth generation who shall live of your enemies to behold your utter destruction. You see, he's going to talk about here the, this is just about, see, this is the time of the birth of Christ. Then he's talking about the destruction of Gomorrah. Except ye repent, and those of the fourth generation shall visit your destruction. Well, après nous le déluge, after us comes the flood, but that's after us, as the French nobility used to say when they're enjoying themselves and getting away with everything. And yea, woe unto this great city of Zarahemla, it's because of those who are righteous that it is said. That's a basic principle of the Talmud and so forth. The Lord's, well, Sodom and Gomorrah, the Lord spares the wicked only for the sake of a few righteous. It is for the righteous sake that it is spared, the 14th verse here. When you shall be cast out, the righteous among you, then what will happen? Then you'll be ripe for destruction. And when the latter day, when the people of the states cast out the saints and said they were ripe for the civil war, Brigham used to say. And what a destruction that was. Well, woe be unto the city of Gideon, yea, woe be unto the city of the Nephites. A curse shall come upon the land. He really pours it on here. Save he be a righteous man, shall hide it up under. Now we have a very interesting thing because of the copper scrolls. That's IQ, it's cave 4, yes. Qumran 4, it's the fourth cave, and then it's the copper scroll from the fourth cave of Qumran. Among the Dead Sea Scroll records was a scroll on copper and bronze plates, just regular sheets, but they were riveted together and then rolled up so they could put them away that way, rather than put them as plates. They could have been placed. Each one has three holes to rivet them together. It could have been used as rings, but they used them as plates and riveted them together and rolled them up. And this is on metal plates. They're particularly important because they wanted to have these records preserved against all danger, against all chance of destruction, because they give the information as to where all the other records are hidden. And not only that, but especially where the treasures are hidden. There are treasures under the tile in a certain public place and so forth. There are treasures under the sewer at the entrance of the, at the temple there. Certain streets, certain corners, it tells us where these things are buried and where to get them. And they're great treasures. And they're the treasures the people were hiding up when they were leaving Jerusalem in 70 AD, excuse me, and then 130 and then 135. And they had to get out, and when they had to get out, they couldn't take their treasures, so they hid them. So they hid them up so they could get them back. And this tells you where to go if you want your treasures back, but only on one condition. They shall be used only for the temple. You can never use them for yourself again. They have been hidden up unto the Lord. They're his now. You can't get them back. Of course, what the people really had in mind was getting them back for themselves. And this is exactly what we're referring to here. When you hide up your treasures with the idea that you'll return later, you must hide them up unto the Lord. You never get them back again. Well, you would get them back. You dedicate them to the Lord, the whole thing. That's fine because you get credit for that. You're expected to do that in Israel anyway. So you're not losing. You're hiding up a treasure. It's yours. But you're getting it back, as you should get it back. I will, saith the Lord, that they shall hide up their treasures unto me, and cursed shall be they who hide not up their treasures unto me. For none hideth, notice how I emphasize this, their treasures unto me, save it be the righteous, and he that hideth not his treasures unto me, cursed is he, and also the treasure, and none shall redeem it because of the curse of the land, you see. Now this has been a work on this. They were edited by the treasures editor. We could have brought them along, we don't have time for this, by Allegro, John Allegro, and the great copper scroll. And the day shall come that they shall hide up, and of course they're writing in plates, and the writer on plates doesn't like it, it's hard, his fingers have hard work, he complains, he breaks down, the symbols become sloppy, just as people who write on the plates in the Book of Mormon tell, if we could only written Hebrew or something like that, we'd be getting along much better, but our hands are clumsy, it's painful to write on these plates, and so they had to write on the plates to preserve them. The day shall come that they shall hide up their treasures because they've set their hearts on riches. See, they want to go back and get their treasures again. That's what they want to do. Watch out for that. And because they have set their hearts upon their riches, I will hide up their treasures when they shall flee before their enemies. That's the whole thing. That's why they were hiding these in the Jerusalem story. See, which is real. I mean, that's the real history. We actually have the documents today. So they left Jerusalem, they hid their treasures, hoping to come back and get them. But the specific statement is in the copper treasure, all these are reserved for use in the temple and in the ordinances. And you can't use them for your private purpose. They've been dedicated from now on. Then, when they shall flee before their enemies, because they will not hide up their them up unto me, cursed be they and also their treasures, in that day they shall be smitten. Ye are cursed. Now here's the old routine again, verse 21. Ye are cursed because of your riches, and also your riches are cursed because you set your hearts on them. That's what cursed them. Have not hearkened unto the words of him who gave them unto you. The economy is all, you see. Ye do not remember the Lord, but you do always remember your riches. You're always thinking of the economy. The only thing we think, I don't wonder if there's ever in this, well, there have been plenty of others, I suppose, and the societies are completely absorbed in the economy. No, it's not a particular society, it's a stage. It's a stage of history, a stage of development in society, which we would call 80, I suppose, the last stage, when they think of nothing but the economy, nothing but the stuff they have, nothing but the perishables. And because they've got to perish, these things can't last, you know, they're in a very bad state. You do always remember your riches. Your hearts are not drawn out unto the Lord, but do swell with great pride, the great swellings, envying, strifes, malices, murders, it leads to that. This is your prime time mix again. This cause hath the Lord caused that a curse should come upon the land and upon your riches, and this because of your iniquities. This is a curse on the promised land, you see. You cast out the prophets. And now we come to a very important thing. It looks just like just like routine platitudes and so forth. There's something like this, the self-righteousness and the like. But this is a very, very important principle that we overlook, and especially today it should be emphasized, we believe, namely this. Now, when you talk, you say, if our days had been in the days of our fathers of old, we would not have slain the prophets, we would not have stoned them and cast them out, then you're worse than they. And then he talks about this self-righteousness. Now, this is the great obstacle to repentance. Here, you see, it's the beautiful self-image which we cultivate today. It's the unbreachable wall. No criticism or questioning can penetrate it, you see. You don't have to bring specific charges or anything. You're just sweetness and light. It's pure Teflon. And you see it, the history of Philip. There's Iago, you see. Iago is the worst of Shakespeare's villains, and yet he is the most upright. He's always moralizing. He's absolutely convinced of his own righteousness, his superiority, and so he's doing just what's right. He means no wrong to anybody. And then these are standard Tartuffe. See, the idea is the worst possible villain is the most righteous appearing person, and has the most glorious self-image of himself. The Tartuffe, there we have... Voltaire's Tartuffe? No, it's not. What's his name? It's Voltaire. And remember the Lord, the worst of them all, you see, are those that broaden their phylacteries, love the high places and the banquets and the greetings in the marketplace, good morning, Rabbi, and spreading out their pious ways and the like. They are the worst of them all. You remember, you hypocrites and so forth. And the worst of those in the Book of Mormon, typical, are those of the Zoramites. Alma 31, we get them. I remember here. Well, I have to, there are many examples here, but this is the point. They are the worst who think they are the best. Verse 18, and again we thank thee, O God, that we are a chosen and a holy people. Then skip over to 28. Behold, O my God, their costly apparel and their ringlets and their bracelets and their ornaments of gold and all their precious things, and they are ornamented with, and behold, their hearts are set on them, and yet they cry unto thee and say, we thank thee, O God, that we are a chosen people unto thee, while others shall perish. How long wilt thou suffer this wickedness and iniquity? You give me strength that I may bear with mine enemies. This is the worst thing you can find, because these people, and they were great people too. They were courageous. They were very neat. They had high dress standards. You couldn't get it. Remember, the people couldn't get it in the meetings without them. And they were always talking about the righteous. They were very clever. They were dissenters. The Zoramites were. And very prosperous. Well, this is the kind of people they were. It goes on here, you see. This holy, holy, holy. We believe thou art God. Every Sunday they'd come and bear their testimony. And thou hast separated us from our brethren. Thou hast elected us to be thy holy children. Well, what an image they have of themselves. Behold, thou art the same yesterday, today. We thank thee that thou hast elected us, and so forth. So this is the best possible defense you can have against repentance, and it's the hardest wall to penetrate. See, once persons get this idea, I say, the Zoramites have it. As Joseph Smith says, let no man proclaim his own righteousness. And that's one of the greatest dangers to Latter-day Saints, he says, because we've been blessed and so forth, and the Lord recognizes us, there's a reason for thinking that we're pretty good and so forth, but look out for that. Because see, what this happens is then this other thing, the prosperity. That's what we're going to wreck it all. Yea, you will say that he is a fault. Now, here's a very good one. Nice culture note here in the 26th verse. It's not finished yet. You are worse than they. If a prophet comes among you and testifies of your sins, of course you're angry. Don't tell us what's wrong with America. What? Tell us what's right with America, as Brother Merritt used to say. Well, when you go to the doctor says, you're fine, your eyesight's 20/20, your digestion is fine, your complexion is good, your teeth are in good condition and the like, and as you leave the office, says, by the way, you have an advanced cancer of the spleen. He hadn't told you that. You don't come to the doctor to find out what's right with you, you come out to find what's wrong with you. The physician is not sent to the well, as the Lord said, but he's sent to the sick. We don't want that. If he comes and tells you what's wrong with you, you say he's a false prophet. You don't want to hear what's wrong with people, naturally. And that he's a sinner and a devil, and you throw him out. But if a man shall say, do this and do this, and there's no iniquity, it's all right. Do this and that, you shall suffer. Walk after the pride of your own hearts. That stands awfully like, a lot like standing tall, doesn't it? Walk after the pride of your own hearts. Yea, walk and do whatsoever your heart desireth. And if a man shall come among you, you will receive him and save as a prophet. And then there's a very interesting thing here. Time is nearly up. In the oldest book we have, the only really surviving book, the Chilambalam, in Central America, the Mayan, the Chilambalam, it tells us that when a man was acclaimed as a prophet, the people would dress him in fine apparel and put him in a sedan chair and carry him around town on, lift him up and carry him around town on their shoulders. See? That's exactly what happens here, you see. If he tells you what you want to hear, he says, you'll lift him up, and he will give them to him of your substance, and of your gold and silver, and you will clothe him with costly apparel, because he speaketh flattering words unto you, and he say unto you, all is well, and you will not find fault with him. Well, there's a picture from the Chilambalam. The prophet is accepted. He is dressed in fine apparel. You know this outrageous overdressing of these people. Put him on a sedan chair, lift him up, and carry him around town. Well, every word of this rings true. Alas, alas, that it should be so. You foolish and blind guides. I thought we would get through with humans, but we don't want to skip any of these goodies here. Well, yes, we'll take up here the next time. Now we have six more times. We can cover some ground in that time. And when I'm away, in February, I have to go to Egypt. And you won't be here, for heaven's sake.